Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Earthquake, eruption, reform fight, and a big nuclear summit this week. A global summit on nuclear security in Washington. 47 nations. President Obama cited progress on loose nuclear material.
Because of the steps we've taken as individual nations and as an international community, the American people will be safer and the world will be more secure.
The battle over financial reform heats up. Republicans shout bailout. Democrats called that Orwellian. Here's GOP Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
If you look at it carefully, it will lead to endless taxpayer bailouts of Wall Street banks.
And a volcano in Iceland shut down air travel in Europe and far beyond. Here's Icelandic safety official Rognvald Olafsson.
This volcano has been surprising us all since it started erupting last month. We don't know how long it will last or if it's going to change again. We just have to monitor it and be prepared to evacuate people if necessary.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Dow 11,000, still no job. Space planes, plans, the Wall Street reform fight. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Chrystia Freeland, now global editor-at-large for Thomson Reuters, formerly U.S. managing editor for the Financial Times. Chrystia, welcome back. Congratulations on your new post there.
Thanks, Tom. It's nice to be here.
And with us from Washington is David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor at the Washington Post. David Ignatius, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Chrystia, and David.
I want to go just straight to some of the Earth speaking this week. I mean, we've got earthquakes on the Tibetan Plateau and all those scenes there. Something like 800 dead and 11,000 wounded, 15,000 homes destroyed, maybe 100,000 homeless. And then the volcano in Iceland with ash over such a huge portion of Europe. Air traffic shut down in the UK and Sweden, Ireland, Denmark, Norway, Finland, and more. Here's one passenger at the Edinburgh airport yesterday.
It's quite bizarre, actually. It's just something that only happens once in a lifetime. I actually thought it was a sort of a late April Fool's Day, actually. I couldn't really believe it.
Chrystia Freeland, this is your home turf. I mean, we've got thousands of flights stopped here, air traffic at a standstill all over, millions of passengers disrupted because, of course, these are hubs for global travel. This is quite an incredible demonstration of what one volcano can do.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm afraid that, sadly for me, my husband is one of those stranded people in London as we speak. He was glad it was such a huge international event because I think he thought I might accuse him of finding an excuse to spend the weekend in London rather than home with the kids.
But we're hearing that there could be another eruption. This could go on for potentially weeks or more.
It's incredible, isn't it? And I think it really shows how vulnerable we are still to the fact that for all our technology and our airplanes, nature can still control us, can't it?
Yes, it can and is at the moment over a huge swath of the planet. And David Ignatius, if we look east to China, there they have out on their western, the flank of Tibet, the plateau, yet another earthquake. We've seen earthquakes just seeming to hop all around the Pacific and now deep into that mountainous territory. It's enough to make Californians nervous, I would think, David.
Well, it's a reminder of nature's power and fury. None of this is as immediate as the earthquake in Haiti, but you do see that we live on an unstable planet where these events no one could have imagined. An Icelandic volcano grounding all air traffic essentially across the Atlantic. One number that I saw in the newspaper this morning that astonished me was that there are 28,000 daily flights across the Atlantic. I mean, there's a little metric for our connected world that basically aren't flying because this once-in-a-century event happens, spewing volcanic ash into the air. The Chinese, who don't like to talk much about Tibet or do much about it or trying to be come to the humanitarian rescue out there. But we always talk about what an unstable world it is. Well, we met it this week in a slightly different way.
Right down to the geophysical. Speaking of power and fury, let's go to the big summit in Washington this week on nuclear security, trying to get a hold of loose nukes, 47 nations represented there. Some breakthroughs, including the Ukraine agreeing to give up its nuclear materials. President Obama is here touting the summit's success.
We recognized that while different countries face different challenges, we have a mutual interest in securing these dangerous materials. So today is a testament to what is possible when nations come together in a spirit of partnership to embrace our shared responsibility and confront a shared challenge.
Christian Freeland, the goal was to get a hold of nuclear material that could fall into the hands of terrorists. The Obama administration says that's the new number one strategic threat on the nuclear front. Is this the U.S. back in the saddle as world leader? This was the most nations represented since the U.N. was organized in the United States half a century ago. What do you think of the summit and how it turned out, Christian?
Well, I would actually like to start, Tom, where you did with Ukraine. I'm a former Kiev correspondent, and I do think Ukraine deserves a little bit of a shout-out, both for this week and also during the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Ukrainians gave up nuclear capacity. They had nuclear weapons on their territory. Ukraine actually is the site of what was the Soviet Union's premier missile production factory and obviously has nuclear reactors. So that's quite a big thing for a country to do, particularly a country that lives in such a difficult and uncertain geographic neighborhood.
How do you interpret it? Is there something, is there a quid pro quo here or just idealism?
I would love to say that the Ukrainians are wonderful idealists who seek world peace above all else. I think it's a combination of weakness and hope, weakness vis-a-vis both the U.S. and Russia, and a hope that there will be, you know, some sort of international recognition of being the good cop in global nuclear politics. But I do think the example there is important. And what's also going to be important is, I think, for other countries that are in a Ukraine-type position where it's possible for them to have nuclear capacity. They live in difficult environments with difficult neighbors. If Ukraine is perceived to be rewarded by the international community, by the United States, I think that sets a good example for others in those kinds of perilous circumstances.
David Ignatius, you're writing this week, after kind of a slow start, about the Obama administration's foreign policy now in your telling, firing on all cylinders. What do you see there, David?
Well, I think the nuclear summit was an example of an administration that increasingly is identifying the key strategic problems in its view and then taking action to project a policy, get global support. The nuclear summit was, in a sense, a piece of theater, but no less important for that. It led to essentially voluntary agreements. It's very nice that Ukraine agreed to give up its nuclear materials, along with Chile, Mexico, Canada. I mean, you know, countries that we don't think of as big strategic threats. What this really represented, combined with several other events over the last 2 weeks, was an effort by the Obama administration to shift the paradigm for the nuclear threat away from our old image of nuclear warheads atop missiles, the Cold War image of the nuclear threat, to the new idea that most strategists who really think about this are worried about, and that is nuclear materials falling into the hands of terrorists or deniable groups that could actually detonate a weapon or a dirty bomb in the United States. In other words, this is the way in which Americans today or people in any country could actually get killed. And so we had the summit gathering 47 nations. We had the kind of rehabilitation of arms control in the New START agreement with Russia that will reduce nuclear weapons 30%. We had a new strategic nuclear posture that was announced a week ago in which the administration essentially said, if you sign on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in other words, if you fight against this danger of spreading nukes, loose nukes, we will promise not to attack you with our nuclear weapons, And that it's sort of hedged, but it seems to be even if you're involved in a chemical or biological attack. So in all these ways, the administration is trying to shift the world's attention, trying to shift the paradigm away from an old one that they think, I think, in my view, rightly, was outmoded, to something new that really gets at the ways that we and the rest of the world are in danger now.
Jack Beatty.
Can I ask David a quick question?
Yes, Christian, please.
I was just going to say, David, I absolutely agree with you both about the paradigm shift point and also this notion of the Obama administration very thoughtfully sizing up a problem and then going after it. But don't you think that on the nuclear issue, a couple of big, more traditional nuclear worries remain, particularly in as embodied by Pakistan and Iran?
I think, Christian, you cite the weak underbelly, if you will, of this policy. But
sorry,
let it be said that the Obama administration, I think, is also trying to deal fairly aggressively with those two problems. It's working to build an international consensus for another round of sanctions by the Security Council against Iran. It seemed last week that it had Russia and China on board for another round of sanctions, probably at the cost of the toughness of those sanctions. On Pakistan, I was with a group of reporters who met this week with the Pakistani Prime Minister Gilani, and he had with him his nuclear expert, who described to us in detail all of the systems of control, the kind of command and control instruments they have to keep their nuclear weapons safe, as he described it. And they clearly have been working with the U.S. behind the scenes to put together these command systems. So I don't want to overstate the Obama administration's degree of success. We still have more balls in the air than caught successfully.
David, hold the thought there, if you would. Yeah, we've got much more to come here. Have to take a short break. We're looking at a week in the news: earthquake in China, volcanic ash out of Iceland, the fight over financial reform. Jack Beatty, Christian Freeland, David Ignatius, please stand by. Sorrowful music here. As the Polish dead come home from the terrible air crash in Russia, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Christian Freeland, global editor-at-large for Thomson Reuters, and our own Jack Beatty. We've got a caller on volcanoes, Columbia, South Carolina. Warren, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Just to build on your comment earlier about how we feel divorced from nature, and yet it reminds us every so often. About 200 years ago, there was a much more massive volcanic eruption in Iceland, which lasted about a year, threw huge plumes of gas into the air, which basically chilled Europe for a year, caused great famine, and was a contributing factor a few years later. This is in the 1780s, was a contributing factor to the instability in France, which led to the French Revolution.
So the Earth always a factor, not just flight delays, but the way we live and maybe the way we revolt. Warren, thanks for a little historical reminder there. I want to get into the financial regulation issue because there was some very hot language and maybe some history, or maybe not, made soon on that front. There's talk of a vote on financial reform package as early as next week. Barney Frank saying that he thinks President Obama will sign financial regulation, a new bill, by Memorial Day. But a lot of Republican pushback this week. Here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell again. He met with President Obama to talk about financial reform. Here he is after that meeting on Wednesday.
None of us ever again want to have a situation where the taxpayers' money is used to bail out large failed institutions.
Bailouts again, the Republican theme. Democrats are pretty grim about that theme. Absolutely not buying it. Harry Reid called it Orwellian. Here he is on Wednesday.
It's obvious that the Republicans are saying no again to progress for America. They have said no to for everything so far, and this is no change.
Jack Beatty, what do you make over the emerging very hot language over Wall Street reform?
Mitch McConnell, I think, made a large mistake this week, or he could have, if he leads his party into a filibuster of this bill. You know, the Republicans have been riding a populist tide. Nothing could be more anti-populist than seeming to be in bed with Wall Street. The week began with Fox News noting that Senator Cornyn and Senator McConnell met recently with 25 Wall Street executives. And in Fox's news, the undercurrent of the gathering was undeniably political. McConnell and Cornyn made it clear they need Wall Street's help to defeat reform by electing more Republicans in November. That's Fox News. Then Mr. McConnell got up and made his speech and said this bill would effectively create mechanisms that would lead to more bailouts. And Time magazine published an article showing that his language, more bailouts, bailouts forever, we have to let these institutions fail. This was right out of a memo that Frank Luntz, the maestro of language for the Republicans, had created, saying the way to defeat reform was to say that reform, in Orwellian logic, was really a way to bail out big banks. And then just yesterday, the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader in Mr. McConnell's own state had a paint peeling editorial denouncing Mr. McConnell for effectively siding with Wall Street against reform. And you know, the issue at stake, the issue is this fund resolution authority in the bill. Essentially $50 billion that would be contributed in advance by the industry to help bury and deal with the orderly liquidation of firms deemed about to fail. In other words,
$50 billion from the banks, Jack.
From the banks. Mm-hmm. In other words, this would be a sort of euthanasia fund. Far from something that would perpetuate bailouts, it would end bailouts. And what McConnell wants to do, which is nothing, let them fail, he said. Of course, that would mean that they're too big to fail. And essentially, that would mean more bailouts. That's exactly what Wall Street wants.
Christian, I want to hear you on this. Let's hear what the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner had to say, talking about financial regulation, rejected the idea that the Democratic proposals in Congress would open the door to more bank bailouts.
We will not support a bill that creates that risk. The central test of credibility on any too-big-to-fail is to make sure we can stand up and say that when large companies manage themselves to the point where they cannot survive without the government, that we put them out of existence. We do so safely with less risk to the economy and in a way that doesn't leave the taxpayers on the hook.
Christian Freeland, where do you come down on this? Never mind the spin, though that's impossible to do, I guess, but on the facts, does the reform seem like something that will stabilize Wall Street, you know, keep us away from the kind of chaotic scene we had a year and a half ago, or as the Republicans say, bring more bailouts?
I absolutely agree with Jack's analysis. And I think that this is a fantastic fight for the Democrats. I think it's exactly what they want. The more the Republicans complain, the better. As for the bill itself, what has been interesting for me is it's actually gotten tougher as it has gone through the legislative process. I felt that initially, as did a lot of people, it maybe wasn't tough enough on Wall Street, but it's gotten tougher. The resolution authority point is quite interesting because I spent yesterday in Washington, and actually some of the more moderate voices in the White House and the Treasury had never really been in favor of the resolution authority of the $50 billion fund. That was something that you heard more from the left of the Democratic Party. I think, interestingly, the Republican objections to that fund, which was also very strongly supported by Sheila Bair, may mean that it has a better chance of actually being introduced. And I think that's a good thing. I think, as Jack says, it's a good thing to have euthanasia authority. The other area that is getting less attention, in some ways, I think is even more important and even more painful for Wall Street, is the whole issue of credit derivatives. And there, I think the very important point is that there should be central clearing. These instruments should be traded through a clearinghouse. There should be full transparency. Wall Street has been fighting very, very hard against that. And I think that is something that it's really important to focus on, because credit derivatives in some way were sort of the accelerant, the fuel on this fire. And there's absolutely no excuse for keeping those operations in the dark.
Wall Street made a ton of money. Those great, great big incomes we saw from there. Warren Buffett, of course, called them financial weapons of mass destruction. And now who's fighting to keep them in? Who's pushing to keep them out? Let's go to Buffalo, New York, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listening to this, I think Mitch McConnell having any sort of criticism, it's very hard to take him seriously since, you know, early on in the Obama administration, he came out saying the way to regain Republican seats and regain power for the Republicans would be to just oppose everything that he does and make him look impotent and make the Democrats look like they can't lead. So, you know, him coming out and saying this is something that's going to perpetuate bailouts, I mean, it just has no gravitas, has no credential to me.
You're not buying it, Steve. David Ignatius, what do you make of the politics here? The Republicans continue to beat the health care reform drum. They say they've got a winner there when it comes to the November elections. What about Wall Street reform?
I agree with Jack and Christian. I think that McConnell and the Republicans are dangerously far down a blind alley. This Dr. No strategy, I sometimes call it, of opposing everything, looked for a while like a winner on health care. But when the president and the Democrats broke through on health care, I think the Republicans don't want to be in the position of opposing action on subjects that the public cares about. And there is no subject that generates more passion than dealing with the residue of the financial crisis. This is not a perfect bill, but it's a pretty good bill. And McConnell's rhetoric about bailouts just is so hollow. It's really shameless, especially at a time when the Republicans are working to kill efforts to, as Christian says, control the trading of derivatives, to move away from this casino economy where people are writing bespoke financial instruments at enormous profits. I mean, these are privately issued, privately traded. It moved towards something more regular, where profits for banks will be far lower. I mean, for the Republicans to oppose that at a time when the public is this angry, I think is the riskiest thing they could do. And I wouldn't be surprised if it really blew up for them in November.
Maybe this is the place to talk about the Tea Party. New York Times out with a big poll this week looking at who and what is the Tea Party, who the membership is. And Jack, interestingly, it goes against at least some people's, you know, sense of the Tea Party. It said, 18% of Americans now identify themselves as Tea Party supporters. That is a very large number for something that, a year and a half, 2 years ago, you know, was just something back in revolutionary days. They are Republican, white, male, married, over 45, more conservative than Republicans in general. I guess that's not a surprise, but also wealthier and more educated. This is not, at least by this poll, Jack, a kind of scrappy rabble. These are folks of means and folks with degrees.
Yes, and I think a book title from the 70s really gets at them. I mean, Bob Kuttner years ago wrote a wonderful book about Proposition 13 in California, the anti-tax revolt in California that really preluded the Reagan administration, and he called it the revolt of the haves. And this is sort of a revolt of the haves. I mean, interviews with these people say, I've got mine, I've got my Medicare, I've got my Social Security, but boy, I want the rest of that government cut down to nothing. But don't touch my Medicare, don't touch my Social Security, don't touch my home mortgage interest deduction. No. And with that sort of, you know, strange political or at least financial positioning, it doesn't seem to add up. There's also this strength, this racial element. By a factor of 50%, the Tea Party members, our supporters,
believe that Obama favors African Americans as president. That is to say, 50% more of them believe that than the rest of the population. That's a, you know, in polls of racial attitudes, that's one of the things that is often used as a marker for racial prejudice. Do you think the government favors the minorities? And polling uses that. You know, they use that question to sort of tap into unacknowledged feelings about race. And there it is, right at the center of this Tea Party sort of demographic picture.
Of course, we've seen that fervently denied when you take TV cameras and microphones into the Tea Party crowds. Absolutely. Sarah Palin was in our backyard right here in Boston this week talking at a big Tea Party event. Well, a few thousand turned out. Here she is talking about Tea Partiers and colonists back in the day.
There are more and more patriots every day standing up and speaking out. These hardworking, good, equality and liberty-loving, good, everyday Americans, ready to take our country back, ready to shake things up. Those of you who won't sit down and shut up, you're sounding the warning bell, just like what happened in that midnight run. And just like with that original Tea Party back in 1773.
There was Sarah Palin. Let's go to Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I was at the Tea Party as a supporter the other day in Boston Common, and I was also a few days previous to that at a meeting at Harvard University, near which I live, where a Harvard Business School professor referred to our new senator as a pickup truck driving yahoo.
This is Scott Brown, who decisively won the race to fill Ted Kennedy's seat.
So I just wanted to say that a lot of us, I don't know if I consider myself a part of the Tea Party, are very, very tired of this kind of disrespect that the chattering classes and the so-called educated classes have for us, and this is one way of us saying we have a right to express ourselves and we have a right to be heard.
Absolutely. Do you fit the profile that they found in the polling, Steve? Republican, white, male, married, over 55, wealthy.
I'm afraid I do. I belong in that that terrible class of people who is white and male and over the age of 50. I apologize for that.
No apologies required, but what about the wealthier and more educated than the average American and more pessimistic? Would that be you?
I don't think people... Am I pessimistic? No, I'm not pessimistic. You know, I have had the advantage of a good education thanks to my parents, but I don't have a great deal of money, but I think I'm above the... I'm certainly out of... I'm living above the poverty level, thank God.
Steve, I appreciate your call today. David Ignatius, what do you make of the Tea Party politics as we roll forward here? Is this building steam as something that you see bolstering the Republican drive to take back the House, maybe, in November or not?
Well, it's a powerful populist movement. It feeds off anger that people feel. I sometimes think it's got a little bit of old-fashioned American isolationism in it. We're coming off a period of difficult foreign wars. Americans often get angry and pull back. They now associate Washington with foreign entanglements and people who were out of touch with ordinary people.
Though the poll found that Tea Partiers support George W. Bush more than the average.
Element of the Tea Party anger that I think the Democrats have to take really seriously. I mean, 18%, you know, it sounds like a lot, but in truth, if the Republicans are pulled toward that 18% base, they will lose. They have to be a broader party than that. But the Tea Party's anger about the fiscal condition of the United States, the rising deficits, and the danger that we are going to become so indebted that interest costs on our debt take up a greater and greater share of our national income. Those are real issues. And I think that the smartest thing that Obama could do is to head off that anger by being really serious about his fiscal and debt commission, which will be meeting this year. If he can really make that a vehicle for addressing this issue that people care about, this is not, you know, crazy people out there on the right or left who were worried. You know, everybody should be worried about it, and Obama's president should address it.
Christia, what do you see in the Tea Party rallies as they unfold? I mean, there's, you know, it's a national tour. There's something going on somewhere every week and probably will be right up to November. Potent force?
Yeah, I think it is. And actually, I have quite a lot of sympathy with Steve, your Tea Party caller, particularly on the sort of disdain that people like us sometimes express towards the Tea Party. And I do think it's a mistake to look at it too much through the prism of racial antagonism. I think that there are some real philosophical issues about the role of government and some real economic issues about to what extent America wants to be a society of redistribution. And I think it's really legitimate for people to be talking about those things.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, First Lady Michelle Obama made a surprise appearance in Haiti with encouraging words for earthquake-hit Haitians.
That is, as Haiti recovers and rebuilds, you will have a steady and reliable partner in the United States of America.
Another big quake rocks China on the long Tibetan plateau. Here are Tibetan monks pulling debris from a collapsed building there. And more than 55 years after his death, country singer Hank Williams got a Pulitzer Prize this week, a Lifetime Achievement Award. Better late than never, I guess. Here's Hank in 1952.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep.
We're looking at a week in the news with Christia Freeland, global editor-at-large for Thomson Reuters, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and our own Jack Beatty. I want to turn to that deficit issue some more, but we've got callers here on Tea Party, et cetera, Mount Dora, Florida. Ross, you're on the air.
Oh, Tom, I appreciate your taking my call.
Sure.
As much as I really support NPR and your show in particular, I've been very frustrated. First, I'll say I'm a moderate Republican, which means I'm an endangered species.
Yes, sir.
That once had money but doesn't have any more.
And
it just seems that any time we start talking in generalizations, saying, oh, well, these people aren't populist, they're not really have the face of America, and start excluding the people who are educated, you know, and, you know, somewhat affluent, you know, I think what we want in our country is more people who are educated and affluent to be in the mainstream.
Hey, I'm all for that. And, Ross, what we're looking to do here is just to look at the results of the poll to try and pin down sort of who's turning out for what. But I take your point, and, yes, let's have more affluent, educated people in the country. By all means, let's have many millions. I agree. Let me get one more call on the subject. Mark in Concord, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. And thanks, Ross. Mark, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to respond to one of your earlier callers who spoke about the disrespectful language that is often directed at the Tea Party, Tea Partiers. I, like him, am over 50 and white and well-educated, and I absolutely agree with his point. This sort of language is absolutely incendiary and inappropriate. You also had a caller on an earlier show this week that referred to Tea Partiers as the toothless masses.
Yeah, I didn't go for that.
Yeah, you didn't go for that, and I was glad you didn't go for that. It's absolutely inappropriate. But I also have to say to that caller that he can't have it both ways. The Tea Partiers and many of the people on the right use very inappropriate and offensive language, particularly about the president, calling him a Nazi and a Marxist and a communist and defacing his image to look like Hitler. That is also incendiary and inappropriate, and I would just like to have all of this come to a stop. We need to have good, solid debate and discussion on these issues, and all of this sort of language is just plain not helpful.
Well, we take your point there, Mark, as well. And let me get one more, if I may. Carlo, Union Springs, New York. Carlo, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I want to get back to this business that's being said about this the economic plan. I mean, when are the Democrats going to stop defending themselves and saying, no, we're not liberal, we're not this, we're not that, and start attacking the Republicans? Mitch McConnell and John Boehner outright lie. They're liars. I haven't heard anyone say, you're lying. They don't belong in the government, those guys. I mean, the bottom line is, I think, they're pimping for the banks. And everybody knows it. So I don't hear anybody say, and they're lying to the American public because they get away with it, because they think the American public is stupid and uneducated. And it's I'm livid over it. And it goes back to your talk about socialism. They get away with that nonsense because people don't know what it is. They don't understand. As you yourself have said, this country, you said a week or two back, we work best when we're a combination of private and public. That's another way to say socialist and capitalist, and that's what works in this country. And I want to hear somebody, I want to hear a politician stand up and say, yeah, I'm liberal, and talk about what that meant. Talk about the mine disaster last week in the context of what happened last century after the laissez-faire and
that was a pretty tough scene. Nobody's going to celebrate that in particular, that's for sure. That's quite a range there from Ross to Mark to Carla. I want to hold that right there, if we may, and get to the issue that our panel has. One of the big issues that the panel is pointing to is behind a lot of this tension, and that is the deficit. It was front and center when Fed Chair Ben Bernanke talked to a joint congressional panel on Wednesday, saying, yes, it has to be addressed.
I think it's fair to say that deficits, structural deficit, longer-term deficits at anywhere between 4 and 9%, anywhere in that range, is not sustainable because it leads to a debt-to-GDP ratio which grows essentially indefinitely. Does not stabilize, leads to higher interest payments, which then feed back into the deficit.
Chrystia Phelan, we circle back to you at last. I think you were headed in, as David was, to looking at that deficit and what's to be done about it. What do you see there? It's a hot political issue, that's for sure.
It's a hot political issue, and it's a hotter economic issue. I think that the deficit is going to be the dominant issue of 2011 and maybe 2012, particularly because, you know, as Chairman Bernanke was saying, it's sustainable right now. Perversely, the United States continues to benefit from economic turmoil elsewhere. So as we have seen problems in Greece, that has strengthened, reaffirmed the U.S. dollar's position as the world reserve currency, which has meant that despite deficits, America continues to be able to borrow money at pretty fantastic rates.
But that's not forever. We saw China with 11% growth news this week. I mean, we've got competitors.
Right, right. It's not going to go on forever. And at some point, particularly once the economic recovery really feels sustained, the government is going to have to handle this. I think the really hot issue, which people are just dancing around, is going to be, does the American federal government go for a value-added tax or a general sales tax? A lot of economists see that as a solution, maybe even the essential solution, but it can be politically explosive.
We had a big conversation about taxes and the value-added tax this week. Let me get a call from Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My concern is that the Democratic Party sits back and allows the Republicans to condemn the spending and who created the deficit. When Mr. Bush took office, there was budget surpluses. There was a pay-as-you-go. The Republicans rejected that. And then they passed the prescription drug plan, not knowing how much it was going to cost or how it was going to pay for it. Plus the two wars that created the huge deficit. And we never hear anything from the Democrats to defend themselves. Am I missing something?
we'll let that question hang right there, Jim, and it's a good one. I want to turn to the space and NASA news, if I may, for a moment this week. President Obama came out earlier this year with new plans for the U.S. in space. Of course, President Bush, had pulled the plug on the space shuttle. Obama pulled the plug on a big missile that was supposed to head back toward the moon, the Constellation, saying it was just impossibly behind schedule and over budget. Here he is on Thursday announcing at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida that he would increase NASA's budget and push for other new spacecraft.
The point is, what we're looking for is not just to continue on the same path. We want to leap into the future. We want major breakthroughs. A transformative agenda for NASA.
David Ignatius, you've got foreign policy. I don't know if that extends into the extraterrestrial. Obama said he wants to get astronauts riding on asteroids beyond the moon by 2025, and in the decade that followed, to be orbiting Mars. What do you see in the president's push here, David?
Well, I think this is, I want to say, Obamian. He's looking at follow-on programs to the space shuttle, and he's saying, these just don't make sense. We've spent a lot of money. We're going to spend a whole lot more on old technologies. I think the most interesting thing that's implicit in the president's approach is he's saying new technologies, new means of propulsion, new ways of getting out of the Earth's atmosphere and orbit to Mars and beyond are coming, and let's not lock ourselves into a technological answer that's soon going to be outmoded. And I really like it. I think that's the kind of leadership that that is rare in Washington, where there's such strong constituencies built up to support existing programs, existing funding streams. Obama's just saying, I'm not going to play that game. I hope he gets away with it.
And the moon, we've been there, he said. Of course, here too, competitors aplenty are out there. China building a huge rocket to lift 5-plus tons in the coming years. Sheila in De Poyster, New York. Sheila, you're on the air.
Hi, this is connected to the Constellation Project, and my question is, I know it was canceled because of cost overruns, and this kind of connects with the deficit, too. And what I want to know is how everybody wants the deficit down. They want the government to clean up its act. But here we have a project that was canceled because it had cost overruns, and the big yell was, oh, my God, all these people are going to lose their jobs. Now, can you really do anything when, ironically, a lot of conservative states have had private stimulus packages for years with energy security, get major government projects in space, in publishing? It doesn't make any sense to me. How can you tackle a deficit when one region of the country is really benefited and definitely doesn't want to give that up?
Right. I hear what you mean. There's so many jobs tied up in this. You can hear that in all the response to President Obama's strategy, every president on this. On the other hand, we're told, you know, over the decades, economic benefits from the research that goes into space exploration. Let me get one more call on this front from South Carolina, Great Falls. Michael, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. My thing is, 30 years we've been sending shuttles up to space. We went to the moon. Great. I think over 70 countries or 100 countries contributed to build this space station. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we do all this research. I think we've been wasting money. I mean, we keep sending them up there to do, you know, research after research. I personally don't think that we've taken a step forward.
Michael, how would you feel if it was, you know, China and India and Brazil who were putting up all the satellites and leading in space? How would that look to you?
Well, I mean, hey, if they will be doing it, that's fine. I mean, we've been doing it, but what I'm saying, what the point I'm trying to get is, Obama wants us to say, okay, let's go to Mars, let's go. I think that's a great idea, but what have we been doing for the past 30 years?
Yeah, well, we haven't been dancing on the moon much lately. That's Michael. Thanks for calling. Jack, what are you making of all this celestial policymaking?
Well, you know, first of all, to Sheila's point, I mean, military Keynesianism and, you know, space Keynesianism has just been part of what we've been doing for the last generation and more. I mean, this is some people think it's a pork barrel. Some people think it's, you know, the frontiers of exploration. Yesterday, I watched President Kennedy's speech in Houston in 1963, I think, where he talked about, we're going to put a man on the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And my heart was moved just seeing that great man speaking again. But, you know, that expressed a different moment in the American experience, a moment when the sky was the limit, when we were at the top of our form, before Vietnam became what it became, before all the, you know, paralysis of politics was introduced, when there was bipartisanship in politics, when we had, you know, something like 70% of Americans had confidence in government, before this tsunami of debt and deficit. We are not that country today. And this talk of Mars and space exploration, I think, is a kind of fantasy. I think it's a sort of, you know, return to the past, to the great days of yesterday. We can't go back. And what's past is that country is gone. We're a country dangerously close to losing its position in the world relative to other powers. And one of the reasons is we spend money on things like
explorations to Mars.
Well, you may be right, Jack. I'm not ready to pack my parachute out of that yet. I mean, so much has come out of that over the years. We'll have to save that for a bigger debate on another day. We've got some breaking news I want to ask you about, Christy, if I may. There's a story just coming out this morning that the Securities and Exchange Commission has, for the first time, filed a civil suit against Goldman Sachs. This is about some packaging of mortgage investments back in the boom. I'm quoting here. This is just in New York Times. Move marks the first time regulators have taken action against a Wall Street deal that helped investors capitalize on the collapsing of the housing market. They're moving in on something, an instrument that was called Abacus 207AC1. Well, we'll learn more about that, no doubt. But Goldman Sachs and the SEC legal sites here, Christian, this is new.
Yes, it is. And I think that it points to something that the Wall Street firms need to be very careful of as they aggressively lobby against the financial regulation bill, which is public opinion is not on their side. And American regulators who really were toothless during the previous decade. I mean, when you look back at the record of all the regulators, including the Fed, the performance is pretty dismal, and I think dismal for ideological reasons. I think regulators tended to see their job as being to grow the financial sector rather than to police it. It's a different era now. And the Goldman case is going to be particularly interesting because I think Goldman actually is the firm that did the best job in the crisis of the big Wall Street firms and ahead of the crisis. They began to spot what was happening with subprime, what was happening with mortgages in 2006. And as far as they themselves were concerned, positioned themselves very wisely. But it looks like the SEC suspects they may have done things which were not fair play vis-a-vis other market participants.
If doing the best job meant positioning themselves to profit it as others went down, we'll see what comes out of that. David, we've just got half a minute here. It's way too little, I'm sorry, but President Obama this week calling a resolution to the Mideast dispute, Israeli-Palestinians, a matter of vital national security interest of the United States. Kind of new language linking back to Petraeus a couple of weeks ago. Do we have a new plan coming from Washington for Israel and the Palestinians?
Tom, there is a debate in the White House about framing an American peace plan for the Middle East. They're working hard on it. They want another few months to let the existing proximity talks go. But I think they're heading in that direction because they feel the parties cannot resolve this without a firmer American hand.
Watch this space, a resolution vital to U.S. security interests, says President Obama. David Ignatius with The Washington Post, it is always great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us this week, David.
Thanks so much.
And Chrystia Freeland, Global Editor-at-Large for Thomson Reuters. Chrystia, always wonderful to have you on board. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, sir. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.